Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Morning, everyone. Welcome to the RSA. I'm Anthony Painter. I'm director of the RSA's Action and Research Centre. And it's my great pleasure to welcome you all here for the launch of Professor Guy Standing's new independent report on basic income, which has been supported by the Progressive Economy Forum and is being presented to the Shadow Chancellor of the Exchequer, who we're delighted also to have with us here today. Before we get proceedings started, I just wanted to say a few very brief words about why the RSA was so pleased to be able to partner with the team at Progressive Economy Forum to host this morning's launch. The RSA has supported basic income experiments because we are in a crisis of economic insecurity. Policy has increasingly leaned away from providing financial support whilst leaning in on managing people's lives through sanctions and so on. This is the worst of both worlds and has predictable impacts on poverty, destitution, and economic insecurity. At the same time, in-work poverty or economic insecurity affects almost half of households. Work alone is no guarantee of security. And on Thursday, we will publish our fourth report on basic income, A Basic Income for Scotland. It will recommend exploring an affordable and progressive system of basic income for Scotland, which could halve destitution immediately and also increase economic security and freedom overnight. And today, we're honoured to host a publication of Professor Guy Standing's landmark report. It recommends basic income experiments in the UK. We agree, and we hope to see it taken forward, and we will provide any support we can to help see it progress. And I'd now like to welcome Patrick Allen from the Progressive Economy Forum to the stage to introduce today's speakers.
Thank you, Anthony, and good morning to everybody. First, I'd like to say a big thank you to the Royal Society of Arts for co-hosting this event and allowing us to use this magnificent room. We're very privileged to be here. As you've heard, I'm the chair of the Progressive Economy Forum, and I'm delighted that we are helping to launch Guy Standing's report on piloting of basic income. Innovative policy is what this, which this report represents, is exactly what the Progressive Economy Forum was created to deliver. The forum was created a year ago to counter austerity and the wholly unnecessary cuts to public services which have blighted this country for the last 9 years and caused untold suffering and economic harm. So our purpose is to show that there are credible, sustainable policies that can restore our economy to prosperity, that austerity is a useless and harmful doctrine. And we achieve our aims through a council of eminent economists and academics. Guy Standing was one of the first to join our council. Our members debate, write policy, blogs, and deliver lectures. And we derive much of our inspiration from the work and policies of John Maynard Keynes, the greatest economist who ever lived. Now, a successful economy has an effective system of social security. A safety net is essential when people suffer economic misfortune due to events over which they have no control, such as illness, redundancy, the 2008 crash, and now globalism. We had such a system. It was devised by William Beveridge, and the UK led the world with humane and comprehensive social security that looked after our citizens from cradle to grave. Unfortunately, it has been severely damaged and is now in crisis. Many citizens are cut off from support, so they have no money to buy food. Children go hungry to school. Homelessness and child poverty are rocketing. People die in the streets, even in Westminster. And yet, we are the fifth largest economy in the world. Our record is shameful, and we were rightly criticised by the UN Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty last year after a two-week fact-finding mission. He said that levels of child poverty were not just a disgrace, but a social calamity and an economic disaster. He cited figures from the Joseph Rowntree Foundation that 14 million people live in poverty and 1.5 million are destitute. Food banks, which scarcely existed 10 years ago, are now to be found in every town and city. The government has engineered a system which creates insecurity. Receiving benefits is difficult and unpleasant. It's a hostile environment for claimants, and it's intended to be, but it is hugely counterproductive. Secure and healthy citizens are likely to be happier and productive and will create a better economy and society. We have to find a better way. Basic income is one idea. Guy Standing knows more about it than anyone. He's written the book, and now this report. It could be a vital part of this answer. Guy considers how pilot schemes could be introduced in the UK. They're underway in a number of countries, and now it's our turn. We need to test the advantages and shortcomings of basic income. First, we're going to hear from John McDonnell, Shadow Chancellor. He needs no introduction. This report has been presented to him. He has every chance of being the next Chancellor, if he can sort out Brexit. Then Guy will tell you about the report and the pilots. And we'll then have comment from Shadow Work and Pension Secretary Margaret Greenwood, Ed Miliband MP, and Caroline Abrahams from Age UK. And then the opportunity for questions. First, over to John McDonnell.
I just thought I could get away from Brexit for half an hour at least. Anthony, thank you very much. I want to thank the RSA for hosting today's event. I'm very grateful also for the work that RSA is doing on this particular field as well. And also thank Patrick Allen. Patrick, within a limited period of time, has established with others the Progressive Economics Forum. It's been doing tremendous work, and I'm grateful for what you do. As he says, he always refers to Keynes as the greatest economist. We usually have a couple of hecklers from either Adam Smith supporters or me on Marx, but there you are. That's another issue altogether. Anyway, look, I want to speak about the contribution Guy's made through the report that's being launched today, and then I want to say something about how this event and the writing of this independent report parallel some of the best traditions of our movement, the Labour movement, and how a Labour government will operate in government. The idea of basic income, a financial entitlement distributed to all, has a long history. And you'll see in Guy's book, his book in 2017, he traces the idea back to ancient Athens and sees version of it expressed in the Charter of the Forest, which we did a successful conference on last year to highlight its role in the past of providing an element of income and sustainable income and sustainable wealth for a large number of people throughout the Middle Ages and beyond. He also identifies it in the writings of Thomas More and Thomas Paine, and in later left thinking, such as the work of William Morris, G.D.H. Cole, and Eric Fromm. But there's no doubt that basic income has come to the fore in recent years as an idea of worth of real consideration by governments. Guy describes it in his book as the fourth wave of basic income thinking that we're going through. In my view, I think we've seen that new wave of support for basic income for a few interlocking reasons. There's been a growing acknowledgement communicated, I suppose most powerfully, in Ken Loach's film I, Daniel Blake, that the means-tested system that has developed in this country and elsewhere is degrading and dehumanising. People are fed up with that system, and actually I think they want to see something different. And we've moved on from the language of shirkers and scroungers. People have recoiled from that, and I think want to see progressive reform. There's also now a widely held view that the stark inequalities tolerated by neoliberalism and capitalism more broadly are unacceptable. Coming out of this has been a recognition that there's a need for a minimum floor of both service provision and entitlements due to all people, which might take different forms we accept. And finally, in a society where many of us work too many hours, there's an increasing debate about reclaiming time and leisure and some form of work-life balance. We've tried to contribute to that debate in the Labour Party because by the launch of an inquiry into shorter working time headed by Robert Skidelsky, and it will look in particular at the experience of people now that we're facing the fourth industrial revolution, the introduction of artificial intelligence more extensively in automation. But what Guy's done in this report is to take the debate on basic income even further still, from an idea worthy of consideration to a real-world policy proposal. He may have inaugurated through his report the fifth wave of basic income thinking. Guy, in the report, recaps the history of basic income and the key elements of any basic income programme, but he also sets out his basic income proposal in the context of, he describes, eight modern giants. That includes insecurity, and yes, of course, the climate emergency. As he'll explain further, he offers extensive criticism of universal credit. He lays out the arguments for basic income and responds to common objections. In terms of universal credit, Margaret Greenwood's with us, our shadow spokesperson, but all of us as individual constituency MPs will have experienced our constituents who've gone through the brutality of universal credit, which is pushing so many people to the edge. So what's particularly useful in this report is Guy's discussions of pilots, and that ultimately is the focus of this report, a basic income pilot for the United Kingdom. In February this year, a preliminary report was written about Finland's basic income experiment, conducted between 2017 and 2018. That experiment, initiated actually by a centre-right party, was in some ways not a full basic income. It applied only to a group of 2,000 people who were otherwise receiving the unemployment benefit and not a broader range of the population. The report only examined the impact of the first year of the experiment in 2017, and a further report will come out next year analysing the second year of the experiment. It's interesting, the report showed that basic income recipients actually were no better or worse at finding employment than those in the control group. However, the well-being of basic income recipients was clearly better, with fewer health and stress problems, greater confidence in their future, and improved confidence about employment prospects. In addition, the report identified that they'd have greater trust in politicians. I'll leave that with you. This is some of the most careful empirical evidence available about a basic income pilot. And yes, we'll await the further report in 2020 with a great deal of interest. Guy covers the Finnish pilots, as well as touching on pilots in North America, in India, and elsewhere. And the helpful appendix to the report selects the 13 most significant basic income pilots, and Guy comments on the methods and their results. What this highlights, and I think what many of you will know, is that there are different basic income models. There are basic income proposals that suggest replacing all benefits with a basic income, and there are other proposals that suggest that a basic income can only be introduced on top of existing benefits. And we should be clear about the politics of these proposals, and yes, the varying agendas of the different authors. Different proposals suggest different amounts being paid out as cash transfers, and there are, of course, also variants on a basic income, such as the RSA's own Universal Basic Opportunity Fund, which proposes its 2 years of basic income style payments for those under the age of 55. And the New Economics Foundation recently proposed replacing the personal income tax allowance with a new weekly cash payment. Guy helpfully offers detailed guidance about how pilots should be designed and conducted, and he sets out five models for a pilot. And he's clear that the funding he outlines is indicative only, not wishing to tie the hands of future Chancellor of the Exchequer. While this is not a Labour Party report, we look forward to considering it closely in the party as we move forward in preparing for government. And there are parallels between the struggle for a basic income and actually the kind of government we want to be. At its very best, the struggle for basic income is not about some pie-in-the-sky ideal, but rather it's a pragmatic project on people's basic needs. Guy's 2017 book was called Basic Income and How Can We Make It Happen? And it's the same for how we want to be in government. Ours is a practical socialism. Our aim is to stimulate, first of all, fresh thinking and to build the debate on careful thinking and, yes, rigorous intellectual foundations. It's appropriate that we have a thinker of Guy's stature writing this paper for our consideration. We've endeavoured to spark a ferment of ideas about Corbynism. And so Guy's work is part of a broader set of papers written for us to develop our thinking. Recently, that's included work by Christine Berry and Laurie MacFarlane on public banking ecosystem. Prem Seeker and his team on the report on the regulatory architecture and other subjects lays out a vision for regulation in the future under a Labour government. And Graham Turner, our city advisor, and his team have written a detailed report on financing investment. I always tell people that I welcome further contributions to that intellectual ferment. Thinking alone, however, is not enough. The call for a basic income has always been backed by an army of activists. Guy is continuing that tradition of engagement with activists and a wider movement around basic income. And he's doing that by holding a series of public meetings across the country to discuss this report. We too in the Labour Party, under leadership of Jeremy Corbyn, have sought to be a social movement now, rooted in communities. And I'm pleased that Labour activists and engaged members will be talking to Guy and other speakers and engaging in this whole ferment of a debate about a basic income and the possible shape of a future pilot under a Labour government. That then is who we are. This is the kind of government we want, to be practical, guided by good, sound intellectual foundations, but yes, underpinned by the verve and enthusiasm of social movements. As we prepare to be that government, Guy Standing's paper, I think, is a valuable contribution to our thinking, and I congratulate him on the launch of this paper, and I look forward very much to the debate that it will stimulate. I welcome Guy Standing and his report.
Well, thank you very much, John and Anthony and Patrick, and thank you all for coming this morning. We all have opportunity costs with our time, so I appreciate you being here this morning. This report, in a sense, is a continuation of work that I've been doing for over 30 years. And you're looking at a man who has the dubious distinction of having been involved in pilots of basic income in five continents. Many countries, some of which are summarized in the appendix that John has mentioned. So you will excuse me if I reflect that yesterday my blood pressure went up a notch or two when I read in a distinguished national newspaper that there is no evidence in support of basic income. I got slightly hot under the collar. And what this report does is try to give a contextual rationale for basic income. I say to John and his colleagues, not all in the Labour Party, but many of them in the Labour Party, that the progressive part of our society has always made progress politically when we look forward, when we have a plan for changing society for the better, and when we articulate that rather than recreate yesterday and lament a loss. And I think the spirit of the basic income debate is about that forward-looking. I look back and I think of the great William Morris as one of the founders with his vision of News from Nowhere, that wonderful book. And I think of people in that spirit. It goes back, as John mentioned, to the Charter of the Forest, which asserted that every person in this country, every free man, had a right to subsistence, a right to work, a right to a home. It is part of our progressive traditions throughout the ages. Now, basic income is not going to be a panacea. It's only one part of a program of transformation from where we are today. For those of you not familiar with the concept, it would mean paying every man and every woman and every child through the parents a moderate amount each week as a right, unconditional in behavioral terms, unlike the means testing and behavior testing that has been strengthened and turned us into a nanny state of punishing the disadvantaged in our society. It would be permanent in the sense that only Parliament could change it through a democratic process, and it would be independently managed so as to take the politics out of determining the level and changes in the level. I've talked about that in more detail in the report and in the book that John's mentioned and in the pilots that we've conducted. Don't have time now to go into it. Those of you who have access to the report, and it's online as well, it's freely available to everybody, can look up for the more details. What I want to do now, in the next few minutes, is give a justification from where we are today. I was going to bring a copy of William Beveridge's 1942 report, and my copy is practically falling to bits. One of the funny things about it was that it was dropped over Germany in the Second World War, and copies were found in Hitler's bunker. And my copy, on page 2, he said, "It is a time for revolutions, not tinkering." And in the same paragraph, a very fantastic paragraph, he says, "We must slay 5 giants. It's a well-known thing among social policy makers: disease, idleness, ignorance, squalor, and want." Today, and this is the theme of the first part of the report, I think we have 8 modern giants that we have to find ways of slaying. The first giant that's before us is inequality. We have grotesque levels of inequality in this country. And it's not just the income that I'm talking about, it's wealth. Wealth inequality is far greater than income inequality. Our statistics underestimate the extent of inequality, allowing certain rogues to pretend that it hasn't increased, because they don't measure the top and they don't measure the bottom, which is rather convenient. But our income distribution system as such has broken down. It's not a British thing, it's a global thing. The share of national income going to capital and to rents has shot up all over the world. The share going to labour has shot down. Wages have stagnated for 30 years in many parts of the industrialised world. It's not just a British thing. And whether you've got strong unions or weak unions, strong collective bargaining or not, this phenomenon is a challenge before us. But besides the income distribution, we have grotesque, I've used this word twice, but it really is grotesque levels of wealth inequality. And the wealth inequality is reflected in just a couple of statistics. One, that the ratio of wealth to national income has gone up to being 6 times as much as national income. Think about it. The second is that 60% of our wealth in this country is inherited wealth. If I'm not mistaken, that means it's a lot of something for nothing. Those people who are receiving the wealth of this country have not done any work for it. So when anybody objects to a basic income about giving something for nothing, just remind them of that fact. Now, a basic income won't eradicate inequality. But if it's properly designed and it's a flat rate and taxed back, clawed back from the wealthy, as it can be done, it would moderate the inequality. That's the first giant. The second giant is different but fundamentally important. I was talking in Newcastle and Sheffield last week, and people were coming up to me at the end weeping. I'm not exaggerating, weeping because of the insecurities that they face. The giant of insecurity is a scourge that's sweeping across the country. More and more volatile earnings. 73% of our workers have fluctuating incomes. And the way universal credit and the means testing and behavior testing that's gone on under this government, and if I may say so, started earlier, is increasing the insecurity. Now, basic security is a public good. It's a superior public good. We all need basic security. We all need to have a sense of which, at the end of the day, we can survive. And the psychologists have taught us that if you are insecure, your mental bandwidth narrows. You cease to have the IQ that you have if you're secure. If you make people insecure, don't think that they can make rational decisions that people who have security can make. Won't go any further into it, but for me, the insecurities are something that policymakers have not addressed in the past 30 years. All the reforms, doesn't matter if they're made more insecure. Well, it does if you're down there. The third giant is something that one would have thought would have gone a long time ago, and that's debt. The government launched a policy of austerity based on the premise that we must cut public debt. And they used one American study to justify it. So they started squeezing the toothpaste tube, reduced public debt, which merely increased private debt. Several years into the austerity trick, they found out empirically it's private debt that causes financial crises. And yet private debt today is higher than at any time in recorded statistics. Our private debt is 87% of national income. Any slight rise in interest rates or slight recession will tip hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, into destitution and homelessness. The average household has £15,000 of debt. I could go on, but the facts are reported in the report. The next giant staring at us is related to the above three. Good research has shown it, and that's stress. We have a pandemic of stress in this country, and it's stress linked to insecurity, linked to many of the phenomena that are described in this report. And again, stress causes illnesses, illness causes demands on our National Health Service, lost working time, and has costs for the economy and costs for society. We have a pandemic of stress, and if our policies don't act to reduce that stress, we will find the other giants that I'm about to talk about getting worse. Because the fifth giant is a phenomenon that hasn't received the attention it deserves, but I've written about this in my precariat books. It's a giant of precarity. More and more people feel they're living bits and pieces lives, and at the same time they feel like supplicants. They have to ask for favor. They have to ask for somebody to help them or make a discretionary judgment. A bureaucrat, a parent, an employer, please. This sense of being a supplicant erodes your sense of being an agent, an independent, free person. It's a reality out there. People feel they are supplicants, which intensifies your stress, intensifies your insecurity, and the rest of it, and leads to dysfunctional personal behavior. But it's not their fault. It's the fault of a system which is creating those conditions. The precarity trap issues that I've discussed, don't have time for now, for me make this a huge giant. We need policies. Margaret, when you come in, think of that, to deal with precarity. The sixth giant are the robots. Everybody says the robots are coming and they're going to make us all redundant. We'll have nothing to do. We'll all be out of jobs and, you know, what do we do with our time? I don't believe that. I don't believe the most dire predictions of that. I discuss the reasons why in the report, but what I profoundly do agree with is that the technological revolution we're experiencing and we will continue to experience are intensifying the insecurities, the disruptions to people's lives. It's not their fault if they suddenly face being redundant or finding they've got to do a whole lot of other things. And also, this is the first technological revolution in history which is creating much more work rather than labor. A lot of activities that people have to do for which they're not remunerated or compensated. But it's the seventh giant that I think will be the tipping point, which will force more and more who are currently skeptical to come round to the point of view we need a basic income. The seventh giant, which I've listed in the report, in the new word that's gaining popularity and strength, is extinction. The threat of the ecological crisis rushing towards us and the need to confront that, sorry to upset John in what I'm about to say, the need for new eco-taxes and taxes on greenhouse emissions and other ecological erosions in our society. Unless we levy against these trends, we will not have an effective remedy to this crisis. But higher taxes are unpopular, and fuel taxes, which the government boasts of keeping down for 9 years in a row, are regressive by themselves. The Canadians and the Swiss have managed to get around this by saying we must have higher fuel taxes, but use the revenue to give out in dividends, which is another word for moving towards a basic income. When that's done, as research has shown by the IMF, World Bank, by sort of groups that one wouldn't expect to be allies, they find that this would be A, more effective than any other policy, B, it would be redistributive, and C, rather importantly for politicians here, it would be popular. It's extremely popular in Switzerland. But there's another point which I don't have time to develop, but it's in the report. If we had dividends and basic income, we would encourage forms of work that are not labour. Care work, voluntary work, the work in our communities, the work of care. These are not valued in our national income statistics, but they're vital to a good society. And we want a system that actually rewards and encourages those forms of work. And they're valuable. And they're ecologically more sustainable. And the final giant is the one that should scare every one of us in this room. And that's the impending growth of neo-fascism and populism of the far right. If you make people insecure, if you make people stressful, if you see grotesque inequalities around you, you tend to listen to the sirens of populists. We're seeing it. It's a terrifying prospect, and we need policies to reverse that trend. Now, as John mentioned, in the latter part of the report, I've moved first to deal with the objections that are commonly made. I think we can deal with all of those objections. Typical objections, unaffordable. There are many ways of paying for it. And I go through the options. They didn't want me to go into detail because this is fundamentally about the advantages of moving in this direction. But there are options, and I would strongly recommend that when John becomes Chancellor, or before, we have a technical meeting with all the various people proposing different ways of funding the transition. Some excellent work by Compass, by RSA, by Malcolm Torrey and others. Bring them all together. See which ways are the optimum way forward. It can be afforded. I'll just give you a couple of statistics. In the report mentioned, I've just got from the Treasury a nice little spreadsheet. The spreadsheet details the 1,156 forms of tax relief. This is the Treasury figures. I was going to tell you, as is stated in the report, that what these mean is that the Treasury foregoes from the top 200 of those 1,156 tax reliefs, £403 billion a year. Most of them have no economic or moral justification. But the latest figures show that last year that had risen to £430 billion. You can start by rolling back a lot of those without raising taxes. Similarly, as John mentioned, and it's mentioned in my report, if we just abolished personal income tax allowances and converted that into a payment of a basic income, just doing that, every individual in the country could get £48 a week. I'm not proposing £48 as the optimum, but you can gradually build up the funding so that you can pay a decent basic income. Now, the other objection is one I feel very angry about. Having been involved in those pilots in various countries, some of which I've listed in the back in the appendix, I know one of the biggest lies told by critics is that if we had a basic income, people would become lazy. They would not work. And yet, every single pilot has shown the opposite. Either minimal effect, as in Finland, was not really a proper basic income, but it was partially, or have found that actually work has increased. When people have basic security, they are more confident, more optimistic. They get round poverty traps. They take on new initiatives. They take risks in their personal lives. Work increases, not decreases. And when they say it's something for nothing, just remember those wealth statistics I mentioned earlier. Those are the sort of objections we're still getting. Now, the pilots that I'm proposing five models, they're listed in the report. We have some people, I think, I hope, from Liverpool who are proposing that Liverpool should be the first place for a pilot. Great, nice to see you, Anne. And I recommend to John that certainly Liverpool should be considered. We have people from Sheffield who've devised a particular model for them. Great to see you here. And we have people in other parts of the country, as Anthony mentioned, four areas of Scotland have been doing detailed plans for introducing pilots, aided by a grant of £250,000 from the Scottish Parliament. We are at the cusp of doing pilots in Britain to a greater extent. We should look at the pilots in Canada, in North America, in the United States, in India, in Africa, and then all show positive effects. It's a matter of courage. I hope in John's first budget that he says that there will be a certain sum of money put aside for doing pilots, without judging whether they're going to be successful or not, but let's see in action. I hope he will set up a commission to look at the feasibility of an economic security future. Put some money aside, find from some of the tax reliefs to do it. I think we can do it, but you know, I don't like spoiling the party for politicians. But politicians, even some of my best friends, tend to have spaghetti spines. And they need us to give them stiffer spines so that they don't lose the nerve. There is always a risk in a progressive policy, but this is a progressive policy for the better. Just remember those people out there, and then we'll do it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Guy. I'm going to draw our panel up in a moment, but just prior to that, I'm going to invite some brief questions from any representatives from the media in the room for John and Guy. So if you are a representative of the media, please raise your hand now. I can see Jim Pickard there straight away, and we'll get a microphone to you. Questions about basic income, please.
It's Jim Pickard from the Financial Times. The first question is to Guy Standing, and it's, have you got any estimate, even a vague estimate, of what the cost of this might be against the existing welfare system? And the two questions for John McDonnell are, firstly, Guy's report suggests on page 40 that the UK is undertaxed at 35% of GDP against 47% for France. Do you agree with that, and do you think that should change? And secondly, John, on page 41 it talks about how a national investment fund should be funded by land value tax and environmental taxes. Is that something you're prepared to consider?
Guys, you want to hear?
Is this working? Yeah. On the first question, I indicate in the report and in several of the footnotes that you can do a basic income which is fiscally neutral. In other words, doesn't involve any big increases in income tax. I am strongly against funding this from further increases in the standard rate of income tax. I think we can get the money from a wealth tax. If I just give you one statistic, which you can take back to the FT, if we had a 0.5% tax on wealth, which is currently valued at £12 trillion, we would raise £600 billion. A basic income is going to be a small fraction of that, or a modest fraction of that. I think there are ways of funding it. I personally do not want fiscal neutrality. I believe that we should increase spending on this. But there are models that do it, and the Citizens Income Trust, for one, has done some estimates. The Compass Report has done, and the RSA have done. So they exist. I think
on the undertaxed element, we went into the last general election with a manifesto and a costed manifesto. We had, if you remember, Jim, the Grey Book, and that was looking at increasing taxes overall. If you remember, increasing income tax on the top 5%, reversing some of the corporation tax cuts that the government's given away and others, introducing a financial transaction tax, and then tackling tax evasion on tax avoidance on some scale. So on that basis, we had set out our proposals for increasing tax overall. But 95% of the population were protected. Excuse me. On the NIB funding, we were funding the NIB through our National Transformation Fund, so a straightforward borrowing exercise on that. And with regard to land value tax, we're exploring land value tax, but specifically aimed at land value tax on non-residential properties to give local government a greater sustainable financial base for the future, and we'll be publishing reports on that in the consultations in the run-up to the next general election.
Great. Are there any further questions from the media? Yes, please.
Hi, Ashley Calburn from The Independent. John, 3 years ago you said you could win the argument on universal basic income in the Labour Party. Do you think you've won that argument today?
I think we're winning it. I think Guy's report will help convince others that this has real potential. My ambition is to argue in favour of a pilot being in the next manifesto, but that will be determined through our normal democratic processes as we lead into the drafting of that manifesto itself. And what's interesting is the enthusiasm of a number of areas, and we've seen them mentioned today by Guy, Liverpool, Sheffield and elsewhere, parts of Scotland, the enthusiasm of people who want to actually undertake those pilots. And the work that the RSA have done and others, I think, have contributed widely to that debate. And I think it contrasts with the understanding that there now is that our social security system is in crisis, with so many living in poverty, the severe social consequences that we've had in terms of 5,000 people sleeping on our streets tonight. The reference has been made to the UN rapporteur's report into the way in which people are not just living in poverty in this country, but in destitution. The separate UN rapporteur's report into the way in which disabled people have been treated, where it refers to the systemic abuse of their human rights, and the fact that we now have 1 million pensioners living in not poverty but severe poverty. So I think there's a mood for change because the existing system is not just not working, it's in crisis.
Any further media questions? Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to ask Margaret Greenwood, Ed Miliband, Caroline Abraham to join myself and Guy on the stage. We'll get some reflections from the other panellists, and then there'll be an opportunity for the audience to ask questions. So, just John, thank you very much for coming along today. So first of all, I'm going to invite Margaret Greenwood, who's Labour MP for Wirral West and a Shadow Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, Her role is to hold the government account on universal credit, disabled people, administration of state pension, and many other things besides. She's going to give some thoughts in brief reflection. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for that. And I'd just like to thank the Progressive Economic Forum and the RSA for this morning's event. And a big thank you to Guy for both the report and that really compelling speech. I think everybody in the room really was consumed by the kind of same energy that you were portraying through it, so thank you very much for that. A real pleasure to be here to listen to fresh ideas about how we can address the very profound challenges that we face in our society. In terms of our social security system, we in the Labour Party believe that we want a social security system that people value in just the same way that they do the National Health Service, so that people understand that it's there for any of us should we need it, we pay for it, it's ours, and there should never be any sense of shame or belittling or the sort of asking that Guy referred to in that, and that's what we want from a social security system. And it's so important that we get that right. Over the last 9 years, we have seen the disastrous consequences of first the coalition government and then now the Conservatives in getting an awful lot of it very wrong. I think Guy's passion around the questions of tackling grotesque inequality and the insecurity that dogs so many people's lives is absolutely key, and he's right to challenge us policymakers to put that at the forefront of our thinking. One of the things I picked up on reading the report, Guy, is this issue that you mentioned again this morning about the precarity in our social security system and how it's less and less able to deliver stability to people's lives. And of course, stability is important not just for the individual, but the communities in which they live and for the economy as a whole, which then, of course, affects all of us. And it feels as if we're very much in a kind of downward spiral with these issues right at the moment. The failure to deliver security and stability is partly because of the government's social security cuts, which will total $36 billion by next year, including $5 billion in disability benefits. It's also because, as Guy rightly points out, the way in which conditionality is used within the system. So entitlement is now subject to a variety of tests so that people are treated differently, not according to what they need, but on how they perform within certain DWP assessment regimes. And certainly that cannot be right. Someone's income is now reliant on them jumping through hoops. So whether that's filling in an online journal, proving that you're spending 35 hours a week looking for work, regardless of whether you have the means to do that, whether you have the literacy levels to do that, whether you have access to a computer, or proving a disability benefits assessor that you're not capable of work. If we think about the 5 million people in the UK of working age who have literacy skills of a 5 or 7 year old or even less, and we consider the really shocking increase in deprivation, it's not difficult to see how wrong that approach that's being pursued by the DWP currently, how wrong that approach is. Sadly, our social security system is far less able to tackle poverty than it was. The latest figures show that 4.1 million children in the UK are growing up in poverty, and that's 500,000 more than there were in 2010. Over the past year, 1.6 million emergency food supplies were given out to people in crisis by Trussell Trust food banks, and of course there are many other food charities operating in communities up and down the country. This really is shocking, and it shows that our social security is simply no longer doing the job that it was set up to do. So that's why we're so interested to listen to radical ideas about transforming our social security system, and why I think this report is a really valuable contribution to that debate. Some of you may be aware, but I'm certainly not all of you will be, that the Labour Party is currently carrying out a consultation into the future of our social security system. We're looking for input from members and beyond. We're calling it Rebuilding a Just Social Security System, and the consultation closes at the end of June, so I would encourage everybody here who has something to say about what that should look like to get involved and submit their ideas. We are clear that we want to put security right back at the heart of our system. We can't afford to do otherwise. There should be no place for food banks in the 21st century in what is one of the richest countries of the world. We are absolutely clear that social security should be about eradicating poverty and not accepting it as acceptable. So I thank you very much for listening to my brief comments on Guy's report, and really look forward to the debate that's going to happen here this morning and the ideas people are going to put forward.
And now I'm going to invite Ed Miliband, who's leader of the Labour Party from 2010 to 2015. He's the MP for Doncaster North and the host of a hugely popular current affairs podcast, Reasons to be Cheerful. Over to you, Ed.
Thanks so much, Anthony. And I want to start by paying tribute to you and the great championing you've done of UBI here at the RSA, along with your director, Matthew Taylor. I think you've been an incredibly important voice in this debate. Well done to Guy on a very good and interesting report. And also to John McDonnell, because I think, John, you are showing an imagination and a willingness to think big, which is incredibly important in our politics. It's important for what a Labour government can do, but also for opening up the space. And we see that in your team, in Margaret, and also, I want to pay particular mention to Johnny Reynolds. He and I worked closely together when I was leader, and he was an important early champion of UBI. It's sort of all been said, really, but I just want to say, I guess, three things about why is this important, this debate. I think first, because it thinks big about our country and how we need to change it. And Guy said, revolution, not tinkering. I noticed John shuddered slightly. I think that thinking big is incredibly important about this, and it plays on a big pitch. And then secondly, what is it that is big about the UBI idea? I think, first of all, that it's about giving people much greater freedom over their own lives. It's what Matthew here at the RSA, I think, calls the power to create. And in a way, I think it's what middle-class people can take for granted, at least some in our society, the chance to have time off from work, the chance to have a career break, a sense of security about what you can do with your life. And really, that is this idea is about extending that idea from some in our society to all. Secondly, I think it's about the redistribution of power in our society. What we've seen over the last 30 or 40 years is a transfer of power from labor to capital. And this gives workers the power to say no. And that power to say no would, I think, represent a really important redistribution of power in the workplace. And I think it could have transformative effects on inequality in our society. And the third, as Margaret implied, is that the third strength of this, I think, in particular, is that it rewrites the nature of the welfare system. And I suppose the report talks a lot about universal credit and the problems with universal credit. And I don't think what it says about universal credit is wrong at all. But I wonder whether part of the issues with universal credit are not intrinsic to any means-tested welfare system in the kind of labour market we're in. Because in a world where you don't have a job for life and you have people floating in and out of work, poverty traps, insecurity traps where people worry about going to work because can they get back onto benefits, the problem of real-time payments to people, I think there's a real question about whether that's just not intrinsic to any system you design. I was involved in the old tax credit system. I think we avoided a lot of the terrible problems of and injustices of universal credit, but I think we saw some of those elements in the system. So I think if you think about the issue of freedom, if you think about the issue of power, and if you think about the issue of a modern welfare system, I think UBI ticks a lot of those boxes. Now, what is the big objection to UBI? I think there's a sort of moral objection, in inverted commas, and a sort of cost objection. I think on the moral objection about work, I think there's different ways of looking at this, because the, if you like, the earliest founders of the UBI idea, Thomas Paine, one of the earliest founders, thought of it as a sort of citizen's share, a kind of share in the wealth of the country. And I think that's actually a strong sort of moral argument against those who say, well, this is about paying people to do nothing. And then in the face of what you might call sort of contested moral claims, as Guy said, most of the pilots have actually shown haven't shown a big reduction in people's willingness to work. I think in the American pilots that happened, believe it or not, under Richard Nixon, it actually showed perhaps younger mothers wanting to spend more time to look after their kids. That's not a bad thing, but actually no substantial, apart from that, no substantial impact on work. And in a way, if we're valuing caring more in our society, that's a good thing, not a bad thing. And really, in the end, the way I think about this work issue is, let's see what it's like in practice. Let's see what happens in practice, because I actually think people will surprise us. I think it's a sort of gamble on human nature, and I think people will surprise us positively, not negatively. And on the cost objection, you know, John's got an incredibly difficult job in working out how to spend taxpayers' money. But I think the question is, what can be the transformative effects of this? And again, I think we can see that from the pilots. If indeed it makes people healthier, happier, gives people a greater sense of security, then it's got to take its place competing for resources against all the other ideas, but it is potentially transformative. The final thing I'll say is where I sort of started, which is, there'll be people who love UBI, people who hate UBI, but I think what I'd say to critics is, this is playing on a big pitch. This is trying to answer big questions that people feel in their heart about the problems with our society. So if you don't like it, fine, but come up with ideas that are big enough to compete with us. And that is, I think, in the end, the real strength of UBI, is it asks big questions about the nature of our society and seeks to answer them. Thanks very much.
And finally, we have Caroline Abrahams. She's the charity director for Age UK, the country's largest charity dedicated to helping everyone make the most of later life.
Thank you very much. And good morning, Just. It's not quite 12 o'clock. What on earth is the charity director of Age UK doing standing on this platform, you might be thinking? Well, actually, I think I'm here to give a bit of a reality check to all the things you've been hearing about this morning and to Guy's report. What would this actually mean for real people in the real world? And obviously, given my job, I'm going to think about this particularly in the context of older people. Now, in his report, Guy sets out his eight giants that need slaying. I think not a giant, but an absolutely very important phenomenon in our society, which you could have put alongside some of these others, is longevity, the fact we're living longer. We have an ageing population. And really, one of the unanswered questions at the moment in our society, I think, is how do we look after people when they can no longer look after themselves? And that's does happen, unfortunately, to very many older people. Not everybody. We all hope that we'll live incredibly vigorous, healthy lives until the moment we just drop dead like that. That's what we all want. But unfortunately, it isn't always like that. And the chances are that for a significant proportion of the population, they will need to be cared for in the last year, months of their life. And we haven't really yet, I think, as a society, worked out. It's just, again, just as Guy said about some of the other things, this is not a UK-only issue. It's a worldwide issue. But it's one that we find quite difficult to think about because it's associated with that dreaded word, death. And so it's expensive and it's difficult for politicians. So there's a lot to do on it. At the moment, there are 7 million of our fellow citizens who are carers. They're people who have often chosen or felt forced out of the labour market in order to look after someone they love. It might be an older parent, it might be their partner. And of course, many of those people are also caring for people with disabilities. They might be children, they could be young people, or they could be people who have developed a terrible disease like motor neuron or MS in their 40s and 50s. That's a lot of people who particularly tend to be in their 50s and 60s. As the state pension age has gone up, it's becoming more and more difficult for people in those age groups, if they're on a low income, if they've not got many skills, if they've not been particularly lucky in life, to keep working. All these sorts of people I'm talking about, just think of the world as it is for people like this. This idea of basic income has got something to offer them, because the truth is, where we are at the moment really isn't working very well. A lot of people who do the right thing, who stop work to care or feel they have no choice but to stop work to care, end up living on a pittance, drawing on any meagre savings they might have put aside for the rest of their own retirements just in order to keep going when they're in their early 60s, creeping up to state pension age, which of course for a significant proportion of people, as we know, particularly women, has gone up very quickly with very little warning. So this also has something to say to the so-called WASPI issue, those women who I think with justification feel very badly let down. these are some of the real world consequences. And let me just finish with one more. As has been mentioned, pensioner poverty, once thought to be going down, was going down. We've done very well. Successive governments did very well through the early part of this century. Unfortunately, going up again now. And there's one means-tested benefit for older people on very, very low incomes called pension credit. It's very important because it can make the difference between being below or above poverty if you are an older person. But we know that stubbornly, over many years, one in three of all the people entitled to it don't get it. The truth is, means-tested benefits absolutely don't work for older people. And the reason for that is that you're talking about people who might have dementia, who are very unwell, who may be too proud to claim a benefit or simply don't know anything about it. And if you look at how hard governments work to alert older people to the existence of pension credit, I think you'd conclude the answer is not very hard at all. And I think there's a little line in Guy's report that talks about those numbers being baked into the Treasury model. Essentially, we kind of collude with the notion that lots and lots of the most vulnerable older people in our society will not get the benefits to which they're entitled. So I think that's just a very quick picture of how life can be for some of the less fortunate people in our society as they get older. And I don't know whether basic income's the answer or not, but I think it's absolutely right to have a look at this or indeed anything else that might make life better for them. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, it's your turn. I'm going to welcome a wide variety of questions, and particularly welcome questions from those who aren't used to asking questions in this sort of forum. I'm going to take it in banks of three, and then we'll hand them out between the respective panel members. I think Lord Skidelsky had a question first of all, then in the back corner there, and then the gentleman right over here. I'm going to make my team work very hard there, and then this gentleman here.
Yes, I have no objections to UBI on cost grounds. I think they've been dealt with. Moral grounds seem to me very firm. But with limited resources, why not direct funds to those in need rather than those who don't need it?
Brilliant, very good. And then question right in the back corner there.
Ruth Lister, House of Lords, and Chair of the Compass Management Board. As Guy knows, I was someone who was pretty ambivalent about UBI in the past. I've become more convinced that at least partially it could be where we should be going, primarily because of the twin giants of insecurity and precarity. My question is, we have a very centralised social security system, rightly so, but how do we do this kind of pilot in that kind of centralised system?
Brilliant, thank you. And then it was this gentleman here right at the back.
Hello, Quaker Monuquist, Basic Income UK. I wanted to ask whether the panel were aware of the consequences of not introducing UBI at a time when male suicide is the greatest killer of men under 40, at a time when job precarity is extremely high, and also at a time when there is 7 billion, according to DWP's own figures, of unclaimed social security. Are we prepared to walk out of this room and be sanguine about the fact that every single day that we do not deal with a failed welfare state, we are condemning people quite literally to death, to mental health problems at a time when the NHS can't afford to deal with mental health problems, and also to a society that will no longer be able to pay people's pensions in about 20 or 30 years because of all of those above situations?
Great. Okay, thank you. I'm going to go to Guy first, then Caroline and Ed.
Thank you for those three questions. First, to Robert. What we learned from Richard Titmus many, many years ago, and Ruth will remember this, is that he said benefits that are only for the poor are invariably poor benefits. You lose the sense of solidarity and the defense of their level and entitlement. They become for them. And that leaves it just as what's happened and just as successive utilitarian governments and chancellors have done, is to say, well, them can be treated less well than us, because us are the majority. And that perspective leads to discrimination and allowing the value of those benefits and the conditionalities to increase. And as Caroline mentioned, all of our targeting, and this is not just a uniquely British thing, it's every country, including Sweden, all the classic welfare countries, when they've moved towards targeting, in other words, just for the poor, invariably you get high exclusion errors. If I then mention job seekers' allowance, the DWP's own figures, not mine, their own figures, 44% of those who are in principle entitled to it don't receive them. And there are various reasons why targeting and means testing don't work. And inevitably, once you go down the road to means testing, in other words, are you poor? Are you really poor? You have to introduce behavior testing. Are you poor because of your laziness or your irresponsibility? Then we have to make arbitrary decisions all the way along the line. And inevitably, you get to where universal credit's got. That's why I call it the end game. Inevitably, you get to the point, well, we'll punish you. Sanctions. And that leads to even more exclusion errors and the terrifying shame of that route. So for me, a basic income is a right. If we want to tax back from the wealthy so that they neither gain nor lose, fine. But that's much more efficient and much more equitable than going down the route of targeting. That's my answer. To Ruth, first of all, I'd like to congratulate you on your great birthday. It's a great moment in life to reach that particular age. And
dangerous territory.
Dangerous territory. But I think you're right also in saying that it's this sense of precarity that I wanted to emphasize in the report. And as you know, I've written the books on the precariat. Those books have been translated into 24 languages, and every single day without exception, I get emails from people to say, this is about me. I'm part of the precariat. I have insecurities. I don't have any rights. I'm losing these things. And that is a clinching argument, I think, in the moral sense of the whole thrust of basic income. I'm glad to know that you've come round to our side, but it seemed inevitable from your earlier work on child poverty, and it's great to have an ally in you. On the third point, all I can say is I fully agree with your perspective in the sense that if we don't move in this direction, those giants are going to get bigger. And populism and neo-fascism and the support of people like Trump and rogues in our own country will increase. That's very, very important. But the suffering out there is intense. It's horrifying. It's undignifying. I cannot tell you how many people out there are suffering, many of them silently or committing suicide or some doing harm to themselves. We've created a society that's a dystopia. We have to do better. And that's the key point that Ed was making, and I thought brilliantly. So thank you very much, Ed, for your comments.
Thank you. Caroline, any thoughts?
Well, I just thought I'd pick up on the third point, because it's very difficult, isn't it, to hear what you've said and not come to the conclusion that we can't go on as we are. I think it's as simple as that, really. And the only point that I'd make from an AGK perspective is that classically, of course, we read and hear a lot about young people, you know, just starting out on life in very difficult situations. And of course, as someone who used to chair the End Child Poverty campaign, you'd expect me to feel very strongly about that. But actually, sadly, it's now also true of what's happening to some people in their 50s and 60s. We hear a lot about now. We've in fact sort of nicked Guy's expression. There is a new precariat emerging, I think, among people in their 50s and 60s who really are thrown back on the means-tested benefits system that was never meant for them, not designed for them, can't meet their needs, and, you know, trying to survive in a very ageist labour market as well. So I'm afraid it doesn't matter, I think, whether you're 18 or 38 and on the minimum wage if you're lucky and having no opportunity to save for the future, we've got to do something about these issues, and I think another reason to take Guy's ideas very seriously.
Thank you. Ed?
I'll just be very brief. First of all, happy 50th birthday, Ruth. secondly, just on Robert's point, I was also going to mention Titmus, but I think in the sort of, in practical terms, two things strike me. First of all, that the most egalitarian societies tend to have the most universal welfare states, Scandinavian societies. I think that tells us something about the way in which you can gain greater public support for welfare states if you sort of pay to a broader range of people. But secondly, I think we sort of underestimate at our peril, as I implied in my remarks, the sort of the real on-the-ground problems of a means-tested system in a world where we have the kind of labour market we have. Now, we want to change that labour market, but, you know, poverty traps of 70 or 80%, which are almost sort of intrinsic to the system. This point I made about the fear that people have of going into work, because then if they lose the work, what do they fall? They're going to find it an absolute battle to get back onto benefits. So benefits offer very, very weak security, but some kind of platform for people. So I think, I've sort of coming round to the view that a lot of this may be just intrinsic to the system, and therefore I think both on grounds of sort of public support and what is actually going to work in today's labour market, I think UBI has a lot to commend it.
Great. Let's have another round of, gosh, you've all prepared your questions while we're doing that round. Okay, well, let's go for briefer questions and briefer answers as well. I'm going to go for this lady here, and I'm going to go for this gentleman here, and then I'll come to the other side of the room.
Hello, I'm Susan Himmelweit. I'm from the Progressive Economics Council and the Women's Budget Group. I like an awful lot of what you've said, Guy. I think as a direction of movement, basic income's very good, and particularly from the point of view of women getting rid of means testing, which doesn't mean means testing on individual income, it means means testing on a household income, often an income that's not yours if you're a woman. That's very good. But I am concerned about what Guy said about care and what Ed said about freedom. Because freedom, you exercise freedom by making choices in a world that's full of norms, and in particular gender norms. And yeah. I can't see a system, if we have basic income without huge other changes in our society, I know who's going to be at home doing the care.
Yeah.
They'll be better supported than they are now, and that's good, but it won't do much for gender equality. It seems to me there are solutions to that, but that involves thinking about the care system at the same time as basic income, and that really makes it all very expensive.
Yes, okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Councillor Anne O'Bain from Liverpool City Council. I'm really looking forward to one of the first pilots being in Liverpool, John, and also welcoming Guy to Liverpool so that we can do what's happening here in Liverpool. Get out of London and talk to real people in the cities. My question, again, is about women. And in Liverpool, we're seeing women very much more at the forefront of the creative and digital sector, often because they are the ones that have lost their jobs through local government cuts. It tends to be women that have lost. So we're seeing them taking a risk of starting their own micro businesses and small businesses and taking those risks. And what I see through basic income is actually that creative sector will grow so much more if they have that basic level of security that will enable them to take the risks we need to grow the economy in places like Liverpool. And just want to know your thoughts on that.
Brilliant. And there's this gentleman here.
Thanks. I'm Jason Lehman from UBI Lab Sheffield, and happy also to invite John and Ed to Sheffield as well.
Can we all have an invite?
Marvellous. Yes, absolutely. You're all very
Sheffield
welcome
and Liverpool.
To come. We throw a good meeting. My question really was something that we found in Sheffield in conversations is that talking about a UBI pilot is a lot easier than talking about UBI. So people say, hey, yeah, that's great. Let's give it a go. But when you actually talk about basic income, they're a lot more equivocal. And So there's an essential concern if you do a pilot, you get a lot of evidence, but then it ends up falling on deaf ears, like the universal credit trials kind of spring to mind. So the counter to this is, okay, well, let's say a Labour government just decides, let's just do this. So forget about the pilots, let's just have a manifesto that joins everything together, you know, joins it with the care system and everything, just comes in and does it, and that's the big change. Is there a reason? Is there a reason beyond producing the evidence? Is there a reason for doing the pilots? Or could you just do it and decide to get on with it?
Great. So we had gender division of labour, we had women and a creative entrepreneurial economy, and then why not just bypass the pilots and go for it? Ed?
Well, look, they're all important points. I'll be as brief as I can. Sue, I think your point is well taken. The Icelandic Prime Minister was here last week, and they are just bringing in 12 months parental leave, 5 months use it or lose it for the man, 5 months for the woman, and 2 months shared. And at both ends of the kind of caring structure of our society, we're going to need big change anyway, whether we do UBI or not, it seems to me. I think the question from Liverpool is really important, because I think, in a way, what I take out of what you're saying is, if you give people the opportunity, they will do extraordinary things. If you demean people and treat them like they're going to be dishonest and criminal, then what's that going to do to them? And in a way, that is part of the change, I think, underlying the wish to experiment with UBI. And then, Jason, your question, I feel like I should sort of defend the Shadow Chancellor here. Look, partly I think there's an expense question. If you were going to do UBI tomorrow, I think it would, and you were going to do it properly, I think it would entail costs. But I also think this is about proving its critics wrong. I think the way to win public support for this is to show real life success for it. And I know you're doing great work in Sheffield on this, but I think, you're in a way, if it works in practice, the critics will be reduced to saying, well, it works in practice, but I don't like the theory. And in a way, I think that's why the pilots will be incredibly powerful.
Caroline?
Yeah, I'll just quickly pick up the care issue, I think. I think you make a very good and fair point. I think the truth is that most people who care for their loved ones do it because they want to. And I do, for example. I'm a part-time carer for my mum. But it's okay for me because I'm in a good job. I have a fantastic employer. I can afford it and I can make the system work for me. My worry is all the millions of women, and some men too, who are not in that position, who desperately want to do something because they love the person in question, but who are essentially punished by our state for doing so, which seems to me utterly disgraceful. But I do think you're right, and everybody's right, that you can't just see this on its own. It's important to have a broader conversation about how we resource care properly in our society. Look forward to having another chat to John about that.
Guy, can you pick up anything you feel hasn't been picked up as yet?
Yeah, I mean, I want to answer Sue's point. I think that perspective, and I'm not saying that this is what you are having, but I've heard it underestimates women. In all the pilots in which I've been involved, where individual men and women have received a basic income, one of the biggest results is that women's status improves because they suddenly have their individual basic income. And one of the results in some of the American studies, which Republicans leapt onto, is it seemed to suggest marital breakups were following people receiving the basic income. So they said, see, it leads to marital breakup. Then they've looked into the data more carefully, and it found that it was women leaving abusive relationships. Now, for me, that's a good thing, okay? I hope it is for all of us in this room. People have a greater sense of individuality and agency. In our African pilots, at the end of the pilot, I went to the places where we were doing them, and I asked some women, I said, what's the best thing for you of having had a basic income for the last 2 years? And after a little bit of hesitation, and some of the young women said to me, well, you know, before, when the men used to come down from the fields at the end of the month with their pockets full, we had to say yes. But now, with our basic income, we say no. That's emancipation. I think all the points you otherwise made, of course we need other policies of care and so on. And you know, you can't win a game of golf with only one club, all that stuff. Now, on the second point, which has not been taken up, I think the framing of the terminology we use is going to be a vital part. That's why I call the report basic income as common dividends. We have to see it as a sharing of the commons, compensation for the loss of the commons, sharing public wealth. And that is why the Alaska Permanent Fund has been such a good example. Because the Alaska Permanent Fund, recently in 2017, the governor, the Republican governor, slashed it because he wanted to cut income tax to zero, and he found he had to slash the common dividends that are being paid out. It was so unpopular that he had to withdraw from his re-election campaign. He's out. And the new man who's come back says, I'm going to restore the common dividends that everybody in Alaska is receiving, and I'm going to increase it because the back pay has been lost. That is the lesson of having a system of common dividends. People buy into it very quickly.
Okay, this is going to be a really quick fire round of questions and a quick fire round of answers. So I did promise this side of the room that we'd get some in. I'm going to take Barb, and I'm going to take this lady here, and I'm going to take this gentleman here. But you've got to be quick. My apologies to the extreme right.
Hi. Yeah, I'm Barb Jacobson from Basic Income UK. It's not really so much a question. It's just to make the point that, again, that this crisis that we're in, this environmental and economic and, you know, is really a crisis of security. And just to say that we really need to rethink how we define work. It's not just, you know, we need to get rid of a lot of jobs simply because they damage the environment. So we've got to think about other ways of having security.
Brilliant, thank you. And it's lady here.
Hi, as but a humble Labour Party member, I'm wondering what I can do to help get this discussed at conference and at my own CLP. And I would also like to extend an invitation for you all to come to Coventry. And how on earth do we get Coventry to be part of the programme? Please.
Brilliant. Coventry, Sheffield, Liverpool. It's going to be a great summer and autumn.
Hi, I'm Andrew Sanchez, University of Oxford. My question is about something that's vexed sort of all basic income trials, and it's been alluded to before, is how are complex and nuanced social scientific findings to be communicated by politicians and by the media such that the results of these studies have the maximum impact, both in terms of advocacy and in terms of outcomes for society? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Caroline, I'm going to ask you to go first on this occasion.
No, I'm going to pass. I think people want to listen to Guy.
Okay, well, I'm going to ask Ed, and then I'm going to ask Guy to close.
Yes, we should definitely come to Coventry. And I think Guy is going to talk more about his tour. I think the point about the sort of environmental aspect of this is well taken. On the thing about complex nuanced findings. I think the thing I would say, and I think Guy does this very well in his report, is the design of the trial really matters. Where was the question about? Sorry, I've... Yeah, the design of the trial really matters. And I think there's been a sort of problem in some of the trials that there's been a lot of chopping and changing, but also what are the sort of metrics of the trial at the beginning? What are you actually seeking to show and to find? And I think that it seems to me that those two things are really, really important.
Guy, some final thoughts.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for the questions. I can only agree with Barb's point, and Coventry, I definitely would hope that would be considered. On the question that Andrew raised, I think we do have a job to do. The results are very powerful from the pilots and from experiments and psychological experiments that, for example, people who have basic security tend to have an improvement in their mental bandwidth. They have an improvement in their mental health, which feeds through to their physical health. There's a lot of evidence out there that if you give people basic security, their health improves, and the vice versa with insecurity. That has feedback effects on the demand on the health service. So potentially it could reduce the costs imposed on our national health service and have some savings down the line. It's the same with work. If you get rid of the worst features of the poverty trap, you increase the number of people able to do economic activities, which increases the tax revenue coming from economic activity as a feedback effect. There are lots of others which have to be explored in pilots. Our Indian pilots found there was a marvelous distributional effect which increased economic activity, increased production, but made it more localized and therefore more sustainable. So there are we need to disseminate the results better. But it requires the media to be fair. And that is the biggest challenge we've got in this country.
Thank you. Thank you to the panel. Thank you to all. And my apologies to those who didn't get a chance to ask a question. I know I've annoyed at least a dozen people in the room here today, and I'm sure you'll pull me up on it. A final reflection from me. We've been spending a lot of time in Fife speaking to a group of citizens, charity workers, public service workers, and so on. They get the situation that they're going that they're in. They understand it's about the relationship to work, the relationship to welfare in the state, the relationship to the social relationships that they have. And basic income puts power in their hands in all three of those situations, from the home to the community to the world of work to their broader lives. So this is why there is such a possibility with basic income. And now I'd like to invite Patrick Allen to the platform in order to close us with some thank yous.
Thank you. Well, we know that the concept of basic income is contentious, but not everyone will agree with it. There's disagreement on my own Perth Council, but there's time for new thinking. As Caroline said, we can't go on as we are. I personally do not believe that giving basic income to our citizens will mean that everybody spends all day in bed watching the telly. The pilot schemes we've heard have proved that this is not the case, and I'm sure that a pilot scheme in the UK will also prove it. But we've had the start of a debate today. I welcome the debate because many people are quick to form a view about basic income without having examined it or read the detail, and so I recommend that they do read Guy's book, the Basic Income, and this report, Making It Happen. Instead of just talking about it, the best way to test basic income is to have a pilot. I hope that pilot will make its way into the Labour manifesto with John's help. We need to put steel into the backbone of the manifesto committee. If basic income can end food poverty and eliminate food banks, it will be worth it just for that. If that's the revolution, I'm all for it. But we need to do more. We need to end sanctions, waiting times, universal credit itself, the bedroom tax, benefit caps. They've all got to go. And the current system of medical assessments, which has made headlines in the paper today. We need to end the system of deliberate insecurity and provide real social security. And this will pay for itself through happier, healthier, and productive citizens. So please pick up a copy of the report, it's outside, or you can download a PDF. I'd like to thank Anthony and Mary and the RSA team for hosting and allowing us to present this report in these superb premises. I want to thank Guy for all your hard work. I think it's worth it. Your speech was passionate and inspirational. So finally, please join me in thanking all of our speakers, John McDonald, Margaret Greenwood, Ed Miliband, Carl Nathan.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.